From our nation's capital, this is Naps Chat.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
Hi, and welcome to this, the 200th episode of Naps Chat. And I'm Bob Levy, the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the National Association of Postal Supervisors. As all postal employees are fully aware, the United States Postal Service is currently amid peak season, a recurring annual time period between Thanksgiving and New Year's, characterized by increased mail volume, network overload, and amplified postal customer concern about on-time performance. Dedicated postal employees have strived to meet customer expectations, but the recently realigned infrastructure seems to have undermined the heroic efforts of frontline managers, supervisors, postmasters, and field employees to provide exemplary performance. Nationwide, first-class on-time performance fell to a woeful 83.29% during the most recently measured week in December. This represents a 7.2% decline as compared to the same period last year. Furthermore, this December number is 9.2% less than the Postal Service's self-imposed first-class performance standard. In a few weeks, the Postal Service will have to file to the Postal Regulatory Commission its fiscal year 2023 annual compliance determination, which, in a major part, will provide an assessment of the agency's compliance with service performance. In addition, Senators Tina Smith and Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota asked the Postal Inspector General for a full audit of postal operations in the state of Minnesota as the result of the Postal Service's subpar peak period performance and the lack of transparency about its infrastructure operations. It is likely that other elected leaders may request Inspector General audits for the areas that they represent. NAPS intends to review the USPS's self-evaluation, Inspector General audits, and the Postal Regulatory Commission's review of the Postal Service's annual compliance determination. Now, let me introduce this week's Naps Chat guest, John Hatton. This is not John's first visit with us. He last joined us about a year ago. John is a friend and colleague. He is the staff vice president for policy and programs at the National Association of Active and Retired Federal Employees, otherwise known as NARF. He has vast experience on issues confronting the federal workforce and postal retirees. In addition to his NARF responsibilities, John formerly co-chaired the Legislative Committee of the Federal and Postal Coalition, which is comprised of over 30 organizations that represent more than 5 million active and retired federal and postal employees and management associations across the country. John has been working in NARF's legislative operations for more than 13 years. Welcome back to Naps Chat, John.
Thank you for having me, Bob. Appreciate it. Always enjoy coming on, even if it's my second time, and being the 200th guest is really quite the honor.
Yes, you're a bicentennial celebrant of this podcast. Let's get to basics. You've been with NARF for 13 years. How many members are there to NARF?
We have about 135,000 members across the country.
And do you know about how many of them are within the postal community?
So we don't have complete data on where people worked in their agencies, but anecdotally, it seems to track with the general percentages of the federal postal population. So I would say somewhere around 20-25%, certainly a sizable contingent of former postal employees.
And I do know a lot of postal employees have taken leadership roles within NARF over the years.
Yes, and I think we have crossover. There's people who are members of NAPS and members of NARF, and we certainly welcome people to be supportive of both associations.
Before we talk about legislation, let's talk a little bit about politics. Both NAPS and NARF are preparing for a consequential 2024 election year. We both use our respective political action committees to elect or reelect congressional allies. Additionally, we urge our members to actively participate in candidate selection and the election process. After all, we're going to be electing the president, vice president, 34 senators, and 435-plus members of the House of Representatives in November. How is NARF approaching this election year?
You know, we'll approach it similarly to other election years. You know, our PAC is also involved. It's just focused on congressional races. On the non-PAC side, we maintain a nonpartisan approach, so we do ask presidential candidates for their responses to questionnaires, and we try to publish those in the magazine. We don't always get a response from each candidate. We might get one of the two. We used to get both. I think things have gotten a little more partisan and a little bit less willing to answer those questionnaires. We have candidate questionnaires for congressional candidates. We typically do those just for new candidates. So if they're in an open seat or a challenger, whereas we might utilize voting records or actions in office for a sitting incumbent. So that is used that we certainly distribute that to members within that district, you know, or their chapters and federations that are associated with that district or state. We also use that for consideration of PAC funds to see if we think they'll be worthy of our support. So we will certainly be engaged in the election season as we are really throughout the entire cycle, trying to support candidates who will support our issues and be at least willing to hear what we have to say and hear our arguments. It doesn't certainly guarantee specific actions or support, but certainly having somebody who has an open ear.
With regard to incumbents, there aren't that many floor votes we have on issues that are of concern of us, particularly in the House of Representatives. That may be a good thing,
right?
On a whole slew of issues. But how do you value co-sponsorships of legislation?
We value it. I think, you know, in terms of what we've published before for our members, we've done voting records. And I think it's a good point you make, and we could consider, do we add in co-sponsorships? And we do on the electronic side on the website. But in terms of our traditional kind of magazine publication of it, we've focused on the voting record. But we certainly value and look at co-sponsorships when we're looking at whether somebody's supportive of our issues, or have they co-sponsored those key bills. You know, particularly, I think a vote is better than a co-sponsorship in terms of really showing when they have to weigh various viewpoints on that particular vote. But when there aren't votes to use, co-sponsorship is definitely indicative of somebody taking real action and putting themselves out there to say, I support this. And I think it's unlikely for somebody to vote against a bill that they've co-sponsored.
An issue that's recently come out, and that concerns, or it's related to, the recently concluded FEHBP open season, and that is Medicare Part D, or the so-called Medicare prescription drug coverage, and the coordination between Medicare Part D and FEHBP prescription drug coverage, because we have a lot of folks who are annuitants who are Medicare eligible and participate in Medicare A, B, and FEHBP. Have you heard about the problems or complications for our folks understanding the interaction between Part D and FEHBP?
Oh, certainly. There's definitely a lot of confusion. We've tried to help educate our members through our webinars. We had one specifically just on this prescription drug plan rollout. So I think there's certainly a lot of confusion. I think the underlying headline here is that it is generally and most of the time is going to be better for you. And so a lot of people are wary of, why am I getting this new benefit without any additional premium? And one of the things that OPM required these plans, which are technically Part D plans, but they're attached to the FEHB plan. So you're not going outside of FEHB to purchase some additional Part D coverage. You're doing it as an add-on to your coverage that's within the construct of FEHB. And OPM said that these plans have to be as good or better coverage than FEHB. One of the really two reasons that OPM decided to encourage to have these plans. Number one is the Inflation Reduction Act, which provided enhancements to Part D coverage. So for FEHB plans to accrue those enhancements, they had to integrate with Part D and therefore get access to some of those Medicare dollars. The other one, I think, is somewhat incidental to the Postal Service Health Benefits Program, in the sense that in that program, you will be required to have this Part D add-on. So some of the benefits again, these are good benefits for Part D are caps on insulin, no co-insurance on catastrophic coverage, overall caps on out-of-pocket spending. That will kick in 2025, but a lot of plans are putting that in place in 2024 in terms of $2,000 limit. So there's a lot of benefits. A lot of the co-payments in the different tiers are lower. It may be a fixed dollar amount as opposed to a percentage of a high amount. So overall, people are generally better. There are a couple reasons that there may be some additional costs for individuals. Number one, if you have higher income, you may be subject to an IRMA surcharge through your Medicare payment. That's if your income is, as an individual, $103,000 or over $200,000 as a married couple. And that gets the first tier of $12.90 per month. It goes up to potential of $81 per month if you have $500,000 or $750,000.
I don't think there are many federal retirees who fit within that category.
So it's a lower IRMA payment than Part B, which is a lot higher. So I think that's one thing to keep in mind. People hear IRMA and they think the Part B payment, but that could be as much as $400 a month. There's a couple cases where if you get prescription drug assistance through a drug manufacturer or pharmaceutical company, that wouldn't be available. And there are maybe some cases where there's tier reclassification. So even if the tier coverage is better under the Part D plan, if you switch tiers, it may not be the same. So it's really incumbent upon individuals to take a look at whether their drug coverage is expected to be better or not. In most cases, in many cases, it will be better. And I think it's a welcome development, even if it's a very confusing development and one that people aren't very trustworthy of.
Let's talk about something that isn't very new. An enduring legislative issue which NAPS and NARF has been grappling with for well over 40 years has been the Social Security government pension offset and the windfall elimination provision. Last month, the House Ways and Means Committee conducted a field hearing on H.R. 82, legislation introduced by Garrett Graves of Louisiana, Congressman Garrett Graves, to repeal those two Social Security provisions, and NAPS and NARF both offered testimony. Currently, the bill has over 300 co-sponsors. That's more than two-thirds of the House. When does it all end, John? And what is it?
Hopefully sooner than later.
Is there an end game?
You know, I think clearly there's a lot of momentum behind these bills, and this is a top priority for NARF. It affects the CSRS retirees, but it also affects state and local retirees, police officers, firefighters, teachers, municipal workers. And, you know, we're at 300 co-sponsors now. That's almost as much as we were at the end of last Congress. So got to a quicker place than last Congress. Last Congress, there's this House consensus calendar rule basically forced a committee action on it. This time, committee wasn't forced by any rule, but they took up and had a hearing the week of Thanksgiving. So the pressure is mounting. I thought the hearing was extremely persuasive in terms of hearing individual stories about how people were taken off guard by this, how it is a real burden on individuals in terms of these penalties. So the hope is we're gaining momentum to have some type of action. Now, I think full repeal still remains an uphill climb because of the cost. And combined with the solvency challenges that Social Security has, where it has solvency challenges in the 2030s, it's hard to add a significant amount of cost to the Social Security Trust Fund without some type of offset. So where you get that offset is not part of these bills. So figuring that out is certainly the biggest challenge. But are there other reform efforts that this can help force through that might not have gotten the attention because this hasn't gotten the same momentum it has now? And so our hope is that continuing the momentum, continuing the pressure on members of Congress, on committee members in both the House and the Senate, forces them to take some type of action on this sooner than later.
One of the components of the GPO WEP elimination is just looking at WEP, windfall elimination provision, and instead of eliminating or repealing it entirely, to make the formula more understandable and fairer. Do you think that is a direction the Ways and Means Committee might take us? I know that Kevin Brady, the former chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, seemed to be moving in that direction.
Yeah, there's a reform approach that's in Jody Arrington's bill, which used to be Kevin Brady's bill on the Republican side, and on the Democratic side, Ranking Member Neal's bill. And there's some differences to it, but they're very similar. They both provide some relief to current retirees in terms of increased benefits per month. And then they use this proportional formula going forward. Now, I'm not sure if it's less complicated than the current formula. I think what's complicated is the actual Social Security formula. So when you start with that and then you have to adjust it, it's all still complicated. The biggest difference between the Republican and Democratic bills is that they both take the better of the new and the old formula at first over time. But at some point in the future, Republican bill phases that out. So that still accrues. So that balances off the cost on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, it does not balance the cost out. But on the Republican side, it might lead to some benefit cuts for some people in the future.
In a couple of weeks, not actually maybe two weeks to be quite to be specific, federal and postal retirees will receive their annuity with a cost of living adjustment, a cost of living increase. Right now, the annuitant population is about evenly split between civil service retirement service annuitants and federal employee retirement system annuitants. But obviously, the percentage of CSR annuitants will continue to decline. Let's talk about the difference in the COLAs that go to CSRS annuitants versus the FERS annuitants, what those COLAs are, and what we are doing to sort of equalize the treatment.
Yeah. So the CSRS COLA is the same percentage as the Social Security COLA, which is equal to the change in the consumer price index that they use. In this case, it's the CPIW. And that for 2024 will be 3.2%. The FERS COLA takes that and takes it down by one percentage point. So it's 2.2%. So if the change is between 2 and 3, it's 2, and if it's above 3, it's minus that 1 percentage point. So FERS is year after year, especially in years of high inflation, having a lower cost of living adjustment, and that annuity and the value of that annuity is eroding due to the inflation of the dollar. So the one main way to address this is to simply correct that, in our view, mistake through the Equal COLA Act, which is Jerry Connolly's bill in the House, Senator Padilla's bill in the Senate. We've gotten more co-sponsors this Congress than last Congress, but it's still a long way to go. I think we're at 41 or 43. I can't remember last count. But we're making some progress, but still, again, a little bit more of an uphill climb on that as well. But it's a very simple argument that make the cost of living adjustment equal to the change in the cost of living.
What's interesting is when FERS was created back in the 1980s, the attempt was to equalize the benefit at the end of the day between FERS annuitants and CSR annuitants. That was the goal.
Yeah.
It would seem only fair that the cost of living adjustments should be the same also.
Yeah, I agree with that as well. And I think some people think, oh, well, they equaled it out then and we shouldn't start tinkering it. Well, FERS has been tinkered with. There's been increased retirement contributions for new hires, you know, and people are maybe living longer than they were and at the time of that change. And these COLAs are a little bit more valuable. So I think, you know, just make the effect of the policy, which is to keep up with the cost of living, be what the policy is.
That brings me to a very scary issue for, I think, a lot of our folks in the federal and postal workforce. And that is an issue that may very well come to the front burner next year. And that's the possibility of a so-called fiscal commission. It's been promoted bipartisan in the House and Senate. This Congress, NAPS and NARF, co-signed a letter promoted by the Federal and Postal Coalition in opposition to the creation of a fiscal commission. Could you talk a little bit about why we oppose the commission?
Yeah. In the past, these fiscal commissions have been used to target federal benefits, among other things. Some of the language that we've seen in what these fiscal commissions would be constructed to do also seem to set the stage for consideration of those types of cuts and really focused on mandatory spending. And having a low threshold for approval of this commission proposal and then expedited consideration of it on the House and Senate floor.
In a lame duck session.
Yes, in a lame duck session. So it removes the accountability of our normal democratic institutions. It takes it out of the process that, you know, really helps secure these federal benefits. And so from one perspective, you know, I think many NARF members, and I suspect many of your members, may see the need for deficit reduction, but is it done in a balanced way? Is it done in a way that's not targeting federal benefits that have been earned over careers in public service? And why can't that be done through the normal process as opposed to trying to do a fiscal commission that hands the reins over to this over some as yet unappointed members of this commission? So, yes, consider deficit reduction. Maybe you need a mixture of revenue and other things, but don't take it outside the normal process. Don't particularly set up a stage that really puts us in the target area of those cuts. And the last time this happened, there was a Simpson-Bowles Fiscal Commission. There was a lot of proposals put out there. Some of those included cuts to federal benefits. The one thing that got enacted after that commission came out was a pay freeze for federal employees. And that was taken up by President Obama at the time. And everything else was not enacted, but that one could be done administratively and was done. So that wound up being a two-year pay freeze extended for a third year. And then in the next decade or so, we saw a few of the cuts actually come to fruition in terms of increased retirement contributions for new hires under FERS. So there's precedent for this being problematic and leading to actual cuts for the federal and postal workforce.
And there was a prior fiscal commission or budget deficit reduction commission under the Clinton administration that was chaired by Senator Bob Kerry was one, and Senator Danforth of Missouri, both moderate members of their party. So generally the scary thing about this, the dangerous thing, is they tend to be bipartisan, but not necessarily federal employee, federal retiree friendly.
Correct. And I'm not sure if this was part of that fiscal commission or not, but the mid-90s included delays to cost of living adjustments for federal retirees and postal retirees. So, you know, that actually hit current retirees and not just new hires. And so there's ways that this could be directed at, you know, benefits that people have already earned.
Yeah, I could remember maybe it was before I came to the Hill, maybe it was just about the time I was early in the Hill, where cost of living adjustments went into effect October 1st, the beginning of the fiscal year.
Yeah.
They delayed it to January 1st, the beginning of the calendar year, as one opportunity to save money at that time.
Yeah, so people lost that cost of living adjustment for 3 months and never got it back.
Right. Last question, and it is many years ago, probably too many for me to remember, when I worked on Capitol Hill, I had the joy of working with so many great NARF members. Some who were true characters, and I say that in a loving way. One retired postal employee who was a leader within NARF was a guy named Charlie Salk, who came from New York City, and I think the Bronx Manhattan branch of NARF is named after him. Could you talk about how individuals can make positive impressions on congressional staff, but most important, members of Congress, and how you encourage that type of visibility and interaction?
Yeah, we absolutely encourage it. I mean, you know, when I go talk to members on the Hill, makes my statements have more weight is that I'm not representing my own personal views. I'm helping represent the views of members across the country that live in their district and our constituents. And what really ties that home and hits home for that is when they're able to know and talk to our members in that district, and they have a face and a name of somebody that they associate with the policies that we're trying to advocate for. And when people spend the time building those relationships with members of Congress, inviting them to their chapters, having a personal relationship where they might get a phone call from the member or can go see the member at a local community event, a town hall, and that member knows who NARF is or NAPS is because they see these members across the country, is absolutely critical to the work that we as an organization do. And you know, we encourage people to send letters. We encourage our top leaders to have meetings. We have legislative training conferences all for this. That's a big part of what we do, is coordinating the activities of our members across the country.
Yeah, I'm just going to say how much I agree with that and how much I associate myself with those remarks, because as I said, when I was a young congressional staffer working for Congressman Gary Ackerman from New York, and when he went on to chair a subcommittee on the House Post Office and Civil Service Committee, I cannot count the number of times that Charlie Salk would either call me up on the phone, show up in Washington, and with his colleague, I believe, from the Queens North, the Queens of Long Island North chapter, a guy named Aaron Trachtenberg, that I would remember these names after 30 plus years.
Yeah.
is, I think, a tribute to NARF and the impression it makes upon members of Congress and even to young congressional staff members.
Well, that's great to hear. And I think that tracks with, you know, sometimes when our members meet with a young congressional staff member, we have to tell them that this person could be, you know, at a higher level in the future, and maybe they'll be representing you as a member of NABS.
Well, John, I'm going to take the opportunity to be the first to wish you to have a happy new year and a great holiday season. I want to thank John Hatton, NARF Vice President, for joining me this week on this, the 200th episode, and the last episode of 2023 of NABS Chat. Thanks, John.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also, I want to thank NABS Chat listeners for logging on this week. If you enjoy NABS Chat, please leave a positive review in the Apple Podcast Store. And more importantly, share NABS Chat with your friends and colleagues. We'll be coming back to you in 2024. So in the meantime, have a great, safe, and healthy new year.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter. And make believe it came from you. I'm gonna